Clyde Barrow and Bonnie Parker were well-known outlaws who robbed banks, grocery stores, and gas stations during the Great Depression. They were shot to death by officers in an ambush in Louisiana on May 23, 1934. 75 years later, people are still captivated by their story. Author and journalist Paul Schneider joins us today to talk about his new book, Bonnie and Clyde, The Lives Behind the Legend. Welcome back.
Thank you, Mindy. It's good
and
to be here.
Now, there have been many books, movies. This topic has been covered a lot. So why did you decide to jump into this again?
Well, I was specifically kind of looking around for a topic in the 20th century and for particularly something in the Depression era. This was, you know, before I knew we would be talking about the next Depression,
right.
Potential Depression era. And but I have to confess, so we were throwing around ideas, my editor and I. I'm very fortunate to have this great relationship with an editor in New York with whom I've done a couple of books. And he, I have to say, it was his original idea. He said, well, what about Bonnie and Clyde? And I thought, Bonnie and Clyde, you know, there must be, as you sort of mentioned, I thought, well, that's a great subject, you know, but there must be other books about it. And I began to look around, and of course there have been, but I felt I became captivated by the story and felt after sort of preliminarily reading around and looking around that there wasn't a book like I would want to write that really sort of attempted to capture take advantage of this incredible wealth of interviews and first-person accounts and sort of primary witnesses.
Mm-hmm.
And so I said, yeah, let's do it. And and it just became this wonderful thing. I traveled all over Texas and Oklahoma, went everywhere, and tracked down a lot of interviews. Not that I did, because mm-hmm. these are all people who have passed away. But contrasting it with the last book we talked about, you know, mm-hmm. when I was here talking about Brutal Journey, mm-hmm. about the conquistadors, you know, just to actually find audio tapes of, you know, eyewitnesses was sort of just felt like a gold mine compared to, you know, 500-year-old conquistadors.
Right. And these are people who were close to Bonnie and Clyde. There were some, you have quotes of their own, but you also, you know, their siblings, the people who you know, people in their gang and whatnot.
Right, right. Mm. And in a way, this gets, sort of as we were talking about a minute or two before we went on the air, a lot of these interviews are there and are recorded, specifically Bonnie's sister mm-hmm. and some of Clyde's buddies. The interviews kind of took place because of the movie. Mm-hmm. I mean, they took place in the 60s, not in the 30s.
Mm-hmm.
But after the big movie with Warren Beatty came out, you know, there was this sort of mad rush to find mm-hmm. anybody who knew them.
Right.
So there's like an old LP record that I bought it on eBay, actually, of Bonnie's sister just,
wow.
you know, being interviewed.
Yeah. Now, one of the things that struck me is, you know, we see a lot, you know, like the movie, for example, very, you know, glorified.
Mm-hmm.
This is not a book that glorifies it at all. This is so, it really brings you into what their lives were really
uh-huh.
like. And in a sense, it's a bit depressing because we really get to see what life was like for them.
Yeah.
And it wasn't as rosy as some might think. You know, you think of gangsters living the high life and what have you, but that really wasn't them.
No, it certainly wasn't them. And in the Depression, there were kind of a couple of, there were two different kinds of gangsters. There were these sort of urban Al Capone mm-hmm. gangs that kind of, you know, lived with corrupt police or however they managed to stay in the city. And then there were people like Bonnie and Clyde who were sort of road bandits,
right?
You
lived
know, and they really yeah. lived in their car,
right?
And you know, for the and at the end in particular, and it wasn't nearly as glamorous as you know, as it might seem,
right.
Particularly toward the end when they're all shot up
right.
and wounded and living in gullies and
yeah.
backwoods and
dirty,
you know, hunted
and
hungry.
Hunted
in every corner. Yeah,
now, we refer to them as Bonnie and Clyde.
Yeah,
but during the time it was really Clyde and Bonnie.
Well, that's interesting. Yeah, it's particularly when you get down to Louisiana and Texas, where they were killed in Louisiana, and they're from Dallas, and there's a sizable community of people who are real students of them, and in a sense, they can tell whether you're really among the educated few if you say Clyde and Bonnie mm-hmm. versus Bonnie and Clyde. Bonnie and Clyde would be, oh, you're just interested in the movie.
Mm-hmm.
Clyde and Bonnie is. But That being said, and they kind of make this judgment about, you know, nobody called them Bonnie and Clyde at the time, mm-hmm. except interestingly, Bonnie did.
Because in her poem,
that's sort of the first. She wrote this sort of ballad of Bonnie and Clyde, and I guess, you know, more things rhyme with Clyde than Bonnie,
yeah.
or else whatever. She knew that it sounded better, so she called them Bonnie and Clyde.
Right now. This great love story between them, love affair
yeah.
between Bonnie and Clyde, and truly you can see they did have this great love for each other. I found it interesting, though, that I didn't know this until I read your book, that Bonnie wore the wedding ring from the man she was married to for the rest of her life, till her death.
She did. Is that it? Yeah. She did. She was married before to, I'm sorry, That's my a- cell phone is going off. I'm being foolish here. She was married before she met Clyde, mm-hmm. and she had a tattoo also, and yes, she never. He went to jail also, her first husband, and she was considering getting divorced from him. But then, when he went to jail before they could get divorced, she decided it wouldn't be. You know, she told her mother it wouldn't be fair, or it wouldn't be, you know, right. a nice thing to do to poor Roy for me to divorce him now that he's in jail.
Yeah, she was 15 when she married him too.
Yeah.
Almost 16.
Yeah, she was very young.
Let's go a little bit to the beginnings. Interesting to see how Clyde is described by his sister Nell. She calls him cute and this sweet little boy, and you know all of this. And
yeah, he was. You know, well, one of the most surprising things about Bonnie and Clyde when you first start to look into who the real Clyde and Bonnie or Bonnie and Clyde is that they were both physically very small people. Mm-hmm. Clyde was the real Clyde was. Only slightly over 5 feet tall, and Bonnie was under 5 feet tall, and you know yeah. really weighed almost nothing, and so they were diminutive sort of people, mm-hmm. And Clyde, yeah, he was like a little brother to mm-hmm. in a large family, and his sisters, you know,
adored him. Yeah.
They really did adore him, and he always had a good, you know, relationship with them, and they were both. Intense family people. When they were out on the road and at times got desperate and times got tough, you know, they would always, at great danger to themselves mm-hmm. and frankly to their family, run back into Dallas, to West Dallas for, you know, a meeting
yeah.
or a visit,
yeah.
you know, out on a secret road somewhere.
Right. And especially Bonnie. Bonnie was very attached to her
Bonnie
mother.
Was incredibly attached to her mother. To the point that her cousins and sisters made fun of her mm-hmm. about how she, you know, hung on her mother's apron strings and couldn't bear to
be without
to
her.
Be
for
without her, but she yeah. also, you know, lied to her mother.
Yeah.
But I guess, you yeah. know, we're mm-hmm. all parents.
Yeah. We're talking about the new book, Bonnie and Clyde, The Lives Behind the Legend. Paul Schneider is the author. Our toll-free number, if you'd like to join our conversation this morning, 866-999-4626. That's 866-999-4626. Our email address is thepoint@wgbh.org. So tell us a little bit about the early life of Clyde and Bonnie. Clyde, poor family.
Yeah. Another thing that was interesting about the research, or fascinating for me, was the degree to which sort of lives were kind of set in stone in some ways, in a pattern, depending on your class and your physical location in the city. Clyde came from a very poor family of sharecroppers, essentially, who migrated to the city as the sort of, along with many others, and ended up in kind of across the river from Dallas proper in West Dallas, which was a slum. Basically, it was a squatter's camp, really. You didn't even really have title to your land. You could just put up a shack and whatever. And, you know, he made a lot of stupid mistakes and kind of got going on a life of sort of petty crime and gets pretty much typecast by the police. And at that point, the way it worked is every time there was a crime, the police would round up everybody who was ever a suspect, you know, just right. the usual suspects. Yeah. And so he'd get hauled in out of his job and, you know, couldn't hold a job. He always blamed mm-hmm. the police
right.
for him not, which doesn't excuse him.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I think what makes Bonnie and Clyde so enduringly interesting is the tension between whether you like them. I mean, whether you feel sympathy for them mm-hmm. because they mm-hmm. had a hard life and they made these sort of outrageous choices to stay free and to live on the run and be heroic in some kind of way. And on the other hand, they're murderers.
Yeah.
And they're, you know.
And it's interesting.
And so you don't know.
With Clyde, the murdering, you know, he obviously has this real hatred for police officers and authority and you know, the prison system. But yet there are other times where he is kind of sympathetic to certain officers he takes along for a ride and lets them go and, you know, and doesn't hurt them at all. And others he just shoots there dead on the spot.
Yeah. Well, I think, you know, Clyde is a murderer. You know, 12
no question.
People,
yeah.
No question.
Yeah.
You know, 11 or 12, depending on how you count them and who you, you know, who you think actually pulled the trigger. But, you know, a dozen people end up dead in the path of Bonnie and Clyde. And but none of them, he didn't murder for kicks. He wasn't a sort of a serial killer.
It wasn't a premeditated
thing.
It was never premeditated,
and it was always, in his own mind at least, in defense. Mm-hmm. I mean, if he could get the, what they called, get the jump on somebody, if he could get the police to drop their weapons, then he would take them for a ride and, you know, let them go and steal their car and have fun with them. And, you know, but if they made the mistake of appearing to pull their own weapon, he was, you know, he was not going to, he wasn't going to wait and see. So he shot in his own defense. And he was usually much better armed than the police.
Yeah.
Because he got his weapons, he raided armories. He broke into.
That was it seemed like he wanted the armories before he wanted any of the money.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. He was gun crazy.
Yeah.
Actually, the first Bonnie and Clyde movie, there's another that was a famous movie in the 40s. And it's also a very good movie. And it's considered to be a Bonnie and Clyde movie. It's called Gun Crazy.
Mm-hmm.
And that movie really got to his gun obsession.
Yeah. And from a kid, he loved guns as a little kid. So he's always loved guns. Now, one of the things before I kind of get into more of that, I want to just going back to his early years, once they moved to Dallas, he started, as you mentioned, to get in some trouble. I found this interesting. Now, of course, there have always been gangs around, but during the 1920s and 30s, there were, you say no fewer than 196 different gangs in Dallas.
Yeah.
196. And then they say even more if you go to West Dallas.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's shocking.
That was shocking. I was kind of felt a little lucky to find this really seemed obscure study by a graduate student at I think Southern Methodist University in Dallas of these gangs. And you know, and it got it up out of the, it came up out of the archives of Lyra's, this old typewritten thing, you know, and they were boy gangs.
Right.
This was specifically boy gangs that this person had studied in the 1930s. And, you know, so this is different sort of than prohibition, whatever, than organized crime.
Right.
So these were sort of street gangs, you know, and he found 192 of them, and it wasn't even in Clyde's neighborhood, which was the tough neighborhood.
It was a tougher neighborhood, yeah.
Yeah,
so
and it's definitely the case that, you know, Clyde and his brothers and, well, at least his one brother and sort of neighborhood kids, you know, they ran a gang of sorts. I mean, they sort of had a tough little couple of blocks.
Stealing bikes and selling them to the...
You didn't mess with the Barrow Boys and, you know, they weren't sort of...
They weren't goody good.
Yeah. Yeah. And then when he got sent off to prison, it just, it hardens into this kind of
anger. The prison stuff is just, I mean...
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
Really awful.
Yeah,
really
he's sent to prison pretty young, 19 or 20, for some petty crimes. And
there weren't prisoners' rights like we have now, for sure.
No.
Yeah, no, it was an awful place to be.
Yeah, I spent a lot of time researching that. And interestingly, you know, we sort of mentioned earlier that I guess this was before we went on the air, but how, you know, I began this book before we had the current recession, you know, and then, of course, depressions and bank failures become all in the news. And interestingly, similarly with torture, I didn't, you know, it was right when a whole country was obsessed with, you know, is torture American and, you know, we don't do this. And then I was researching these Texas prisons and it was perfectly legal to hang people from their wrists from the window bars until well into the 20th century. That was not even considered, you know, bad treatment. And Clyde went through that.
And they would, to get out of some of these work camps, they would actually chop off a foot or a hand, and Clyde actually chopped off a couple or had somebody chop off a couple of his toes so that he could get moved to a different prison.
Clyde was desperate to get out of this prison. It was a prison farm, really.
Yeah.
And essentially essentially they were old slavery farms, plantations that they just sort of moved over to a new source of free labor, which were convicts. You know, they were cotton farms, and the work was intense. And Clyde, yeah, he got a friend to cut some of his toes off in order to try to get transferred back to the main prison at Huntsville, which worked. Unfortunately for Clyde, he did it 2 weeks early because his mom managed to get him parole 2 weeks later.
Yeah.
So if he had just held off,
he always
had a little funny limp in his walk.
Let's talk about Bonnie's early life.
Okay.
She was a great student. She could sing. She was entertaining. She had so much promise.
Bonnie was full of spunk and very intelligent. She won the spelling bees at the Cement City School where she went, and she was in all the school plays, according to some of her classmates, and very friendly and lively, and loved to sing, and she had a theatrical sort of bent to her, which, you know, maybe served her well when she was sort of a celebrity on the run, and she, you know, but she obviously gravitated toward what you might call the wrong guys.
Mm-hmm.
We already spoke about her first husband who was a burglar, yeah. And then, you know, but it was an interesting sort of mix of lawmen. Some of her other suitors in that time were sort of deputies and lawmen. So she was just in this kind of like and tough kind of milieu.
Yeah.
But she was a waitress, and she became a poet.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
In the car she was writing.
She'd write things.
Things. Yeah. Yeah.
And she meets Clyde, and it's kind of there's an attraction immediately between the two of them.
Yeah. They meet at sort of a party or a friend's house. You know, introduced through a friend of a friend, and Clyde made everybody hot chocolate. Mm-hmm. That was his. Like, it's funny to think of like Clyde Barrett,
really,
you know,
drinking hot chocolate,
making everybody hot chocolate, and that, you know, sort of, and they hit it off, you know, pretty immediately.
Yeah. Although when you say that, Clyde was not a big drinker.
No,
he I guess had enough wits to know that if he was drinking, he would be caught. And
Bonnie becomes a bit of a drinker,
right?
You know, at the end, towards the end, the later descriptions of her, she's often sort of drunk, essentially. Whatever it means. Although she was also had been in a bad car wreck and was wounded and was shot and was, you know, so she could have also been drinking just to kill the pain.
Kill the pain, yeah.
But Clyde was, you know, he wasn't a teetotaler.
Mm-hmm.
But he. Everybody says he didn't drink.
He
didn't drink specifically because he wanted to have his wits
about him.
Yeah.
We're talking with Paul Schneider. His new book is Bonnie and Clyde, The Lives Behind the Legend. Our toll-free number is 866-999-4626. That's 866-999-4626. Our email address is thepoint@wgbh.org. The book makes the case, and I know there's others who've made the case here, that Bonnie never fired a shot.
I don't quite make that case actually, but there are, that is sort of one of the kind of long simmering debates about Bonnie. People who love Bonnie, you know, as a historical character, some of them want her to be, a kind of gun-toting proto-feminist, and some of them want her to be this innocent bystander. I think she loads the guns, for sure. I think she fired them, actually. There's enough eyewitnesses of her, of women. Mm-hmm. Whether it could have been her, it could have been her sister-in-law, Blanche.
Mm-hmm.
But she didn't fire, she didn't kill anybody.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, if she killed anybody, it was...
By accident, you think?
Well, no? You know, I mean, not by accident necessarily. If you're shooting a gun out of a window in the general direction of a gunfight, it's not really an accident. But she didn't kill anybody at point blank Clyde did.
Right. Now, but her sister talks about the fact that she didn't like guns when she was younger.
Yeah.
And she was, you know, wanted nothing to do with guns. Yeah. Kind of ironic that she ends up with all these guns around her. You know, and if they've got, I mean, when they're traveling in the car, I mean, The number of guns
is absurd.
It's unbelievable.
Points.
Yeah,
where they're basically sitting in the back seat with their feet up on, you know, there's five people in the car, and, you know, 17, you know, automatic rifles and 23 handguns. I mean, it's sort of a joke.
Yeah. But that shows Clyde's obsession with guns.
Clyde's thing. And, and in fact, there's one point where they kidnap actually, this is a scene that the movie relates reasonably accurately. They kidnap a mortician and another woman. And, you know, in the real story, the woman's there kidnapped and the bullets keep falling out of the glove compartment, you know, and Clyde finally, you know, makes her hold. So she's sitting there kidnapped by Bonnie and Clyde holding this, you know, pile of ammunition on her lap. I mean, it was a little...
Excessive.
A little nutty at the end. Yeah.
Now, we hear so much about the love affair between Bonnie and Clyde, which, of course, there's certainly evidence that they were truly in love with each other. But I think the story of Blanche and Clyde's older brother, Buck, is equally as strong. Blanche really stood by her man. And
no, it's yeah. And in a sense, that you're getting right to the point of what also makes this kind of such a powerful story, regardless of what you think of them as, you know, sociopaths or Epicureans, whatever. But the sort of idea of these two couples that are together somewhat, and Blanche and Buck are almost more tragic because they're sort of there by accident.
Right.
Buck's there because he thinks, I mean, Buck's probably the dumbest of the four, and Blanche might be the smartest of the four. I mean, Bonnie's more creative and more artistic, but she, you know, or whatever she is.
But Bonnie will follow Clyde.
But
no
Blanche
what.
Has got more sense, I guess, maybe, as opposed to, you know, And Buck, you know, gets out of jail and thinks he can change Clyde. And Blanche just begs him not to go, begs him not to get together with Bonnie and Clyde, because she knows what's going to happen.
She knows that,
And they, you know, and they get to Joplin, Missouri, and they're kind of having this weird little fantasy of a family vacation, you know, four bank robbers in a little apartment, you know, and then the police come and it becomes this big shootout. And at that point, Blanche and Buck are locked in. They can't get out. And you're correct. Their story kind of is like a mirror of Bonnie and Clyde's.
Yeah.
And their love, Clyde and Bonnie's love for each other, is what makes them sort of a, you know, almost like an American Romeo and Juliet. Mm-hmm. It's got this sort of romance at the heart of it, you know. Although it's not like they're from opposite families. They're not from two different clans, but they're in this one clan against the law. And the law is almost this kind of like a clan.
It's interesting because Bonnie, of course, talks to her mother and says, makes her promise she won't say any. They know that their days are numbered.
Yeah.
And towards the end, they know any time their lives are going to end. And she promises makes her mother promise that she will not say anything bad about Clyde after they're dead.
Yeah.
And that she'll bury them together.
Yeah. Well, she keeps
keeps half of that.
Keeps half of that.
Yeah.
They're not buried together. Bonnie's mother said, you know, Clyde had my daughter during her life. And I'm going to have her, you know, now. And that is an interesting part of it. And then the grave has been moved. Bonnie's grave is actually not even where it was. And the graves are interestingly in sort of obscure places in West Dallas. It takes a little look. You got to know where to go to find them. But there are plenty of pilgrims who do.
Yeah,
you know, and then they have a reenactment of it's out in Gibson, Louisiana. There's a reenactment every May of the shootout.
Yeah, let's talk about that. Talk about the ambush. And what happens at the end.
Well, the ambush happens at the end, essentially because there's a kid traveling with Clyde and Bonnie, Henry Methvin, whose family is desperate to get him separated from Bonnie and Clyde, and they ultimately are approached by the Texas law folks and the Louisiana law folks. And a deal is sort of struck whereby this kid will get a pardon from Texas if he can engineer the turning in of Bonnie and Clyde. So it all works out similar to the movie. They're driving down a road. They managed to separate the kid from the group. And there's six lawmen hidden in a hidden in the bushes. And Clyde and Bonnie come down the road and stop at a truck that they recognize as this kid's father's truck. And then the shooting starts. Mm-hmm. And, you know.
And again, excessive bullets.
Many bullets. Yeah. And yes, excessive. And obviously, you know, it's a trial. It's without any trial or anything. But in the defense of these lawmen, you know, there were 12 of their comrades who had already been killed by essentially giving Clyde a chance.
And how many times did Clyde get away?
Right. You know, and he'd gotten away from, you know, he was actually not that great a bank robber, but he was a brilliant escape.
He could drive.
Shoot him up, and he could drive like the wind.
Yeah.
So, you know.
And he had a hunch, like he had hunches. You know, there were times where he would say, okay, no, we're going to turn around here, and he'd be right. You know, he'd see something that didn't look right or what have you. So he was good at that.
He was good at that, and he always had faster cars. He stole the fastest cars, which were Ford V8s, and he knew most of the police were still, you know, it was a depression. There wasn't a lot of money around. They were still driving Model A's and Model T's, and they didn't have radios. I mean, there's a lot of things that Clyde and Bonnie had in their advantage in terms of their run. Right. The police couldn't radio ahead. They couldn't cross state lines.
I think what might surprise people, too, is their ages when they died. Yeah. I hadn't really thought about that before, but Bonnie was 24, Clyde 25.
Yeah, they were young, very young.
They were very young.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, so, and the whole thing takes place, you know, when they're just kids.
Yeah.
I mean, and the parent, you know, at this, it is surprising. Mm-hmm. And it's surprising, actually, how brief their run from the law was. Yeah. It's really
4 years total, right?
Not even, really. Right. I mean, it's really 2 years of you know, hard on the run. You know, ahead of the law, one step ahead of the law.
Yeah.
But there's two ways to look at that. You can also, it's also amazing how long they managed to survive.
Right.
Doing that.
Yeah.
You know?
Exactly.
So.
Well, yeah. And as we said, you know, and towards the end of their lives, I mean, they were dirty all the time, hungry, living in the cars or sleeping in the ground.
But still incredibly in love. I mean, Clyde is carrying Bonnie around at that point because of this car wreck that had ruined her leg.
Yeah.
So everywhere they go, you know, he's carrying her.
Fascinating story. Paul Schneider, author of Bonnie and Clyde, The Lives Behind the Legend. Thanks, Paul, for
being
here.
Thank you, Mindy. It's been fun.
I'm Mindy Todd. Thank you for listening.
The Point is hosted and produced by Mindy Todd. The executive producer is Steve Young. Production assistance from Dan Treidel and Jenny Jenker. Theme music by Benjamin Verdery and William Coulter. The Point is a production of the Cape and Islands NPR stations, a service of WGBH Radio.